I'm being recorded.
Yes.
So my sponsor can verify all the facts real quick. Is Gary in here? Nope. All right. I'm going to give you a version of the truth. I'm going to do about 40 minutes worth of it, and I apologize in advance if I offend anybody, but because I don't ever want to do that. So I just want that disclaimer before I get started. And y'all are a good-looking group. Man, y'all are a good-looking group. Got to work out the kinks real quick for my own. I just got to be in that space because up here, I'm up here. I want to tell you one thing, but from here, I need to tell you another thing. So, just kind of work that out for a second. All right, my name is Christian. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is August 7, 2001. My home group is the Mount Vernon Group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Sandy Springs, Georgia. My beautiful wife, Lori, accompanied me tonight and is so grateful for her. She's a byproduct of working the 12 steps, living a spiritual path, and carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous to all places that you're ever asked to do it. And I thank you for the invitation to Tom. If you guys have a problem with my talk, Tom McNally. He's the guy who asked me to come out and share with you guys. And I just want to apologize ahead of time because the last thing I ever want to do is offend anybody. I have an enthusiasm for Alcoholics Anonymous. I have an enthusiasm for places like Howe Place. 33 years. I was 10. I hadn't even had my first drink when they started doing this thing here. And thank you for the readers for sharing the people who had gone before you and your experience with them. Because that's what it's about, man. This thing started when two liars got together and tried to figure out the truth. This thing started when Bill Wilson, in a vain attempt to do the only thing that he knew worked, desperately sat down with another alcoholic. And he didn't sit down with the other alcoholic because that guy was an alcoholic. He sat down with them because he's an alcoholic. I'm not here because y'all are dope fiends and alcoholics, because I'm pretty sure y'all are some thoroughbreds in here. I'm here because I'm an alcoholic, and this is something I'm going to get something out of. So my very first sponsor is a guy named Don B. And Don and I went to a jailhouse and did a little meeting over there in DeKalb County. And I started telling some of the guys there, I said, you know, it's kind of like doing this. And I started describing how to commit a crime. And he did this. He pulled me real close. He says, you know, they know how to get in trouble here. You don't need to tell them that. So I'm going to describe to you in a general way what my life was like as an active alcoholic. What happened to me and what my life is like now is a direct result of being sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous for 14 years. My story is going to be a lot like some of yours and very different than others. So I guess it helps to have a first drink. I started at 14, which is really late nowadays, man. There's like some people coming in right on time at age 16, you know. And we see them at the Mount Vernon group. We do two meetings a week that are regular meetings at 8 o'clock, a speaker meeting and a closed discussion. We also do beginner's meetings on Monday and Thursday. We do those at 7 o'clock, and it's 45 minutes. And we see people who are fresh, like just that day drank. And we also get a lot of other people. And so I want to acknowledge real quick the programs of HA and CA and CMA, because they're utilizing the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they're helping people who were dying in the rooms of AA because they weren't identifying. They weren't understanding what we were talking about. However, I have found that alcoholism is the common denominator. Because you take alcohol out of the alcoholic, and what are you left with? Ick. That nasty... I guess it would be described as a restlessness, irritability, and discontentment. A general kind of like, what's the point? How can I possibly get out of bed in the morning if I don't have something to drink or whatever that other thing may be? And I have a lot of other things in my story, and I'm just going to say it just like that. They're fortifiers. They help me drink a lot more, which is really my goal. But we're finding that if we in AA can help the people find the HA meetings or the CA meetings or the CMA meetings, they seem to get better. Just this year in the Fellowship of HA, they've had at least 7, if not more, people that I'm aware of who have died. We're into April. That's not good. All right? So this disease is killing people left and right. All right? Having said that, I didn't have my first drink until I was 14, and I was a lot shorter then. I was 4'9". All right? I was a freshman in high school, and I went to Lassiter High School over in East Cobb County. So this is my old drinking and stomping ground. From here all the way over into like Sandy Plains Road, Piedmont Road over in East Cobb County. That's where I drank and got high. That's where I did all my damage. And so I didn't have my first drink until I was 14, and I was 4'9". I hadn't hit puberty yet. Everybody else had, and I hated them because they had hair on their body and parts that I didn't have hair on my body. I felt like a little Ken doll. You know, I was completely bare, and I hated it. I hated going in the showers during PE when I was over in my freshman year because everybody else just had the sense of confidence, and I wanted to hide. Now, I'm going to share this with you because it's important. I didn't hide because I hadn't gone through puberty yet. I hid before that. I hid before I even knew this was going on. I hid, like, internally I hid. I'm the kind of guy that, like, I always felt a little different. It's like everybody else knew what was going on but me. Even though I understood what was going on, I still felt like I didn't get it. And I couldn't understand that. The thing is that on that fateful day, it was the Friday after Thanksgiving, my freshman year, I had been invited by an upperclassman. He was like 5'10". He was a giant, you know, and he invited me to go to this party. And I had seen Porky's in Fast Times, so I knew what to expect, and I was not disappointed. I'm here to tell you, man, it was great. There's people over here kissing, and people over there dancing, and keg stands, and people doing this beer bong thing. I didn't understand what that was, and another kind of bong thing, and smoking. So I wasn't sure what that was. And they were having a blast, man. And there was good-looking girls, and the men were handsome, and the women were all hot. And I knew, I don't belong here. I just knew I didn't belong here. And somebody handed me... It was a beautiful experience. Somebody handed me
props.
Somebody handed me a tall boy of Coors. And they said, listen, what we're going to do here is we're going to shotgun a beer. I'm game. I have no idea what the hell you're talking about, but I'm down. And he said, it's real easy. You take a pen, you pop it in the bottom, one fell swoop up, pop the top, and it all runs down. Now, in theory... That's a very easy thing to do. I hadn't done it yet, though. So when I did it, half of it went down the front of my shirt. Now, I want to point something out about alcoholics. We're not quitters. We ain't quitters. We go through to the other side. And I did. I grabbed another beer. I basically kind of bit down on that bastard. I popped that top. And something happened. As it was running down my throat and it hit the interior of my stomach, something happened. It only seems to happen to people like us. My mom, I asked her after I got sober what happens to her when she drinks, and she described some of the stuff, and I'm going, nope, 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 nope. I'm looking for the checking. She doesn't get it. Something happened. I went from being 4'9" to about 5'10". My shoulders spread. Hair started to grow everywhere. All the important places, right? My voice got real deep, and I became extremely talented at everything I thought of. Now, by the way, that didn't happen. When I woke up the next morning, I was 4'9" again. But that night, something happened. I felt and acted like I always wanted to. I felt confident. I felt like I finally got it. That thing that had eluded me my entire life, I got it. As I continued to drink, by the way, which is something that we do, I then investigated Cisco. All right, y'all know where that goes. So I investigated Cisco, and it's a great wine. You screwed the top off, you know, the good quality wine, right? And I drank that, and unfortunately the party we were at had white carpet everywhere, so I promptly then decorated. I'll put it that way. We all ate. But I decorated, and those who know how to decorate when you're on Cisco know what I'm talking about. Red wine does not come out of white carpet very well, especially this stuff. I experimented... I'll say it that way, on some of that non-habit-forming vegetative matter. And I learned a lesson the first time. You don't cough into that bomb. You know, and I had a great time. I had a great time. I felt like I always felt, wanted to feel. I looked in my head like I always wanted to look. Strong, confident, aware of everything that's going on around you. I wanted that. And I was so pissed off the next morning when I woke up and I was 4'9" and again and scared. What I experienced the night before was something that we all seem to chase. We can't explain why we chased it until we got here and we realized that we're around other people who chased it the way we did. My drinking continued to progress as often as I could get it. It had a lot of additives in there. Ended up following the great... I dropped out of high school. I was like a straight-A student. I dropped out of high school because it seemed like a good idea. And it allowed me to drink and use the way I wanted to. Went on tour with the Grateful Dead, had a good time with that, I'm told. Hazy memories, you know, over in Virginia somewhere, and, you know, in a parking lot. A lot of parking lots. Not a lot of shows, a lot of parking lots. Because that's where everybody hung out and drank. did what we did. And to this day, the smell of patchouli, I get a weird reaction around it, you know. But a lot of dandelion wine, a lot of homemade stuff, and, you know, selling grilled cheese sandwiches for like $20, you know, those kind of grilled cheese, and drinking that homemade hooch, and just, it wasn't what I wanted. It was fun, but I wasn't happy. There was no harmony. It was a lot of just kind of wasted weekends. Now, I'm not knocking the dead, by the way. I love that experience. But the whole thing I was chasing, I didn't find. So I changed gears. Came back to Atlanta and decided to be into like heavy metal and listening to industrial music and going down to the Masquerade and the Metroplex and places like that. And, you know, I don't fit in very well down there. I had my ass handed to me quite a few times. And they drank a lot of vodka and a lot of Everclear, and that was fun. But it wasn't who I am. And then I decided, you know what I need to be as a bartender. So, I was a great bartender. You know, I drank a lot. I'll put it that way. I knew you're drinking. I drank a lot. So I was a bartender over at Taco Mac over 1990 and 1991. And when the Braves beat Pittsburgh, you know, let's pound Steel Town, and Crazy Leg Sid Bream made that mad dash from third to home, I was just cheering them on, just sloshed and drunk as can be. And it wasn't really what I wanted to do. You know, and as a bartender, I did the bartender thing. You know, you make drinks and serve drinks. But at the end of the night, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning, you're cleaning the bar mats, right? And this is something only alcoholics do. As you're cleaning the bar mats with soda water and you're pouring the contents into a pitcher, and the other guys are at the bar going, I bet you $20 you can't drink it. Yeah, I'll take that $20 bet. Now, here's the thing. I was going to drink it anyways. Because there was like vermouth and vodka and martinis and all this other stuff. Chicken tenders and cigarette ashes. Who cares, you know? I'm not drinking this for the flavor. I'm drinking this for the effect. And I didn't get that. I didn't get that I was drinking it for the effect. The effect is it calms my spirit. It allows me to be comfortable in my skin. So I continued all this until 1998, March of 1998. I've been homeless for 19 months. You can fill in the blanks what kind of homelessness I was. I was a couch surfing, back of cars, behind buildings, behind a dumpster, cattles, and all those like places that we kind of sometimes end up at. I just made a career out of it, and I did it for 19 months. And I hit my bottom, and I went back home like all heroes do. And mom let me back in, and that was the first time I'd even spoken to her in 6 or 7 months. And I think it took 10 years off my mom's life, and I didn't care. I ended up promptly robbing her blind, taking her wedding ring or engagement ring, and took anything that wasn't tied down to sell so I could get another drink. And in March 26, 1998, I attempted my life for the last time. You know, it was my fifth suicide attempt since I was 14 years old. Now, I don't belittle suicide attempts. I think that's just where we end up. Whether I'm drinking myself to death or eat a bullet. And I don't ever, ever feel good hearing that somebody took their life, man. That sucks. It sucks because we could have reached them. But I did my last suicide attempt. By the way, it didn't work. I made it through. I got a happy ending to that story. But I ended up in the place called Salvation Army, and I went there. I was in Salvation Army for 13 months, and I did nothing to better myself. I was a great meeting maker. I went to meetings all the time. I was a good sharing meeting maker. I heard something over Friday night at one meeting. I went to All Saints meeting on Saturday, and I shared what I heard, you know? And everybody's like, damn, that's good. And I was like, yeah, that is good, man. Now, I hadn't done it. You know, it was all good stuff. I just had no experience with it. So, like my first sponsor, Don, used to say, he'd be like, oh, you one of them good sharing MFs, ain't you? You heard a lot. You ain't done a lot, but you heard a lot. And I relapsed. Back in 1998, didn't see it coming. Just didn't see it coming. I met a girl. I'm not saying that's a bad thing necessarily, but I met a girl. And I stopped just going to meetings. Now, I had no program, I had no sponsor, I had no connection to God, I had no spiritual experience going on. I just go into a lot of meetings. And if what you can do right now is make meetings, thank you. Sometimes we aren't infected with alcoholism until we've made enough meetings. I know that my own experience is I caught alcoholism in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. A guy named Scott Redmond said it beautifully. It enters through the ear. We suddenly identify with that feeling that we have, and somebody shares it. It's like I hear me being shared out of somebody else's mouth. And I don't know how else to describe it other than just that. I'm listening to somebody share my feelings, my fears, my anxiety, all that crazy stuff that goes on in my head and my gut. I'm hearing somebody else share it. So when I relapsed, I stayed drunk for a year. Now, by the way, I never went back to the couch surfing and homelessness. I actually did pretty good. I was a sous chef over at Ansley Golf Club. I did a lot of good over there. Won the coveted Employee of the Month award, because you got to have goals, you know. And, you know, I got that Employee of the Month award, and I got the little check, and I went back to where I was living at the time, and it dawned on me that there was three trash cans in my room. Three 30-gallon trash cans in my room, and they were all filled with bottles, empty bottles. I went to go grab a pair of shoes in my closet, and as I went to grab them off of the shelf, I realized there was boxes full of empty bottles. Now, I had just emptied that room of bottles the prior week. I was a big beer drinker, man. I loved beer, and I drank whatever I could get my hands on, but beer was really my thing. And there was hundreds of bottles in that room of beer I had drunk in a week. Not counting all I had drunk while driving, or at work, or at the bar, or at friends' houses. And I thought, man, I got a problem here. It's not a problem with drinking. I have a problem with not drinking. Because if drinking was my problem, then just coming in here and not drinking anymore would solve my problem. So I came back to the same homeless shelter I had lived in before at the Salvation Army. And I sat there and I listened. And this was August 8th, 2001. A month and 4 days later, a bunch of us were sitting in a circle getting in touch with our feelings, and we watched a bunch of towers come down in New York City. We watched America come to a standstill, and fear gripped everybody in that place, because what the hell's the point of doing all this if our world's just coming to an end? And I watched four people get out of that circle, and they all died as a result of their alcoholism. They left. I stayed for whatever reason, because I had heard a guy named Dallas who had gone to a meeting over in Decatur called the Heavy Hitters Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And Dallas had come back saying, you need to come with me to this meeting on Saturday. So this was Tuesday when all this happened. That Saturday, I went to the meeting of Heavy Hitters, and it was weird. It only took me about 10 minutes to figure out I was the only white guy there. All right, and I'm pretty observant, right? All right, and I'm like, there are no other white dudes here, you know? And by the way, it's not an issue about the black or the white. I just don't want to be different. I hated being different. And I heard these guys talk about alcoholism differently than I had at the homeless shelter. Because see, in the homeless shelter, you know, the old timers, the guys are like 90 to 100 days. They're holding us down in the middle, keeping us safe, telling us great stuff like, just don't drink. You know? We do this one day at a time, but we just don't drink. There was no mention of steps. There was no mention of sponsor. Let me rephrase that. If they said it, I didn't hear it. But at the Heavy Hitters, everybody seemed to have a big book. Everybody they broke the meeting into two, and they went, did a 12 and 12 study over here. Everybody in here, and it was always solution. It was always big book. It was always about getting in touch with a power greater than ourselves, which will solve our problems. See, the problem is I didn't know what step one was. When I looked at step one, I thought it said that I can't drink. See that? We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. It doesn't say I can't drink. What it says is that I'm going to drink. I'm powerless. 14 and a half years sober. I am just as powerless today as the day I walked in here. I am powerless. I will never regain the power of choice to drink or not drink. I have a mind that tells me, you know what, it's going to be different this time. Or, even more sinister, hey, you know when you spoke over there at that how place? Remember how they judged you? Remember how they like, yeah, you know how it is. Yeah. What we should do is probably just have a drink or two. I know. Don't freak out. See, the first time I heard Earl Hightower talk about the internal voice that goes on, that's the first time I really got what alcoholism is. And for me, and I hope I don't offend anybody, alcoholism is a manifestation of an allergy, an obsession, and a spiritual malady. And that spiritual malady just gets me a little restless, irritable, discontent. I just feel like I can't, it's like I want to settle down, but I can't. And like, why is everybody pissing me off? And nothing's ever good enough. Now, it was great enough when I walked in, but now it's a month later and I'm expecting it to be better. Well, I'm only a month away from my last drink. I haven't done anything to improve my life. Of course it's not better. But at the time, I couldn't see it. And I picked my first sponsor based upon the car he drove, which, by the way, I've heard of weirder things to pick a first sponsor on. He drove up. It wasn't his car, by the way. It was a nice car, but it wasn't his. And I asked Don to be my first sponsor, Don B. And Don B spoke real quiet. He'd be like, hey, listen, listen. And I'm like, shit, all right, I got to get close to listen to him, you know? He goes, listen, what we're going to do here? And he described alcoholism from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I hadn't read ahead yet, so I didn't know he was coming from this book, right? Had I read ahead, I might have known a little something, but I didn't. I was a head full of nothing but lies. I had a head full of nothing but bad ideas and broken ideas. I had a head full of crazy belief systems. You know, like if I tell you how I feel, you use it against me. If I drop my armor, that you'll hurt me. That if I ask for help, it makes me less of a man. Those are old ideas I picked up on some playground from a fool. You know? So Don helped me get in touch with the first step. He most importantly got me in touch with what the second step suggests. Coming to believe, all right? Now, see, I have a Roman Catholic mom and a Southern Baptist dad. Nothing against either one of those, but in our home, there was a lot of friction, all right? They couldn't talk about God because they all had to talk about the church. And what they did is they clashed their religions. I'd go to my mom's church, and it's this very quiet sanctuary. You could hear a pin drop from all the way across the sanctuary. And it's like she tripped or something when she got to the pew. I wasn't sure what she did, but her knee hit the floor, and I didn't understand that. And then she got on the begging bar, you know, in the pew. I didn't know what that was. And she started counting these beads, and I didn't have beads. And then halfway through the service, they all got up and got, like, juice and cookies or something. And I couldn't go. I hadn't gone through confirmation. I hadn't gone through catechism. I couldn't go. And I'm like the one poor bastard sitting there all by myself. Everybody's in line. And it's like I could feel them looking over going, Mommy, is he going to hell? Now, I'm like 8 years old. I don't know any better. But it doesn't take much for somebody like me to feel different. And my dad's church was the opposite, man. It was like a town hall. Everybody's, woo, all right, having a good time. You know, there was like a bake sale out front. Everybody was going on a missionary trip somewhere, you know, and there was all this stuff. And they would ask me questions like, hey, are you saved? I didn't know we were supposed to be saving. It was like, I don't got any money on me. You know, I didn't know what he was asking. I hadn't been exposed to either religion, but that's what I knew about God. In one of the houses, I'm not good enough to get in. And in the other house, I have no idea what you're talking about. And I was screwed. So when second step came, Don suggested to me, he says, Christian, what you understand about God isn't important. How you act is, the actions you take are going to make a change in your life. And he took me to the big book, and I'm really glad that they knew I was coming. Because they did. They really knew I was coming. You know, the suggestion of the big book is this. You know, no mind can comprehend or conceive that power which is God. I just have to be willing to open myself up to it. And Don did this for me. He says, religion says this. Religion is a construct, the man, that says, you have to believe what we believe, and if you do, you can pass through. You can pass through this theology, this doctrine, this belief system, and there's nothing wrong with it. But I didn't know how to get through that. What he says spirituality does is says whatever works. And he suggested a tree, and then he questioned me about the tree, because he says, what if I have a chainsaw? And I was like, damn. And then I suggested maybe like a doorknob. He goes, what if it's locked? I was like, shit. You know, I was like, damn. You know, I was like, he goes, how about your own conception? And he gave me a third step assignment, and that's assignment, I was come up with my own conception of God. Whatever makes sense to me. By the way, my conception of God over the last 14 years has evolved dramatically. And the reality of what we have in the 12 steps is there's no bad ideas. They're all ideas that we're going to practice. We're going to challenge them. We're going to wrestle with them. But the most important thing is that we something action them. You know, I embrace them. I walk through them. I engage in them. I experience them. I question them. I change through them. And that's, I think, what the whole process of the 12 steps gives us, is this opportunity to change, you know, through this spiritual kindergarten, if you will. So I took the third step, and the third step immediately put me into a place of having to write. I didn't want to write, and he reminded me it's your favorite subject. So I started looking at resentments, fear, and sexual misconduct and harms to others. And I looked at these things, and I never really stopped to look at them. I always dwelled on them, but I never stopped to look at them. And he suggested it's really nothing more than a series of lists, observations, and prayers. Write out the people you're mad at. I was like, that's cool. Yeah, I could do that. And then, you know, what's coming, right? It's more than just writing out their names and who, you know, what they did. I had to stop and consider how this affected me. Because, see, the problem was I can't change them. I can't change what happened. What I can do is I can acknowledge that self manifested in various ways is what had defeated me. I have to consider all the common manifestations of self. I can't change them. I can't change you. All I can do is do and initiate a change in me. So I looked to these people, and I had to start praying for those sorry SOBs who don't deserve my prayer. But they got all my attention. But I can't somehow give them a prayer, right? So I had to start praying to him. And he took me to the prayer in the fourth step. He took me to 552 in the fourth edition and looking at that prayer, praying for them and so that they could have the... Because you know what? It's not about them getting it. It's about me wanting it for them. It's about initiating a change in me so I am freed from the bondage of self. The whole point of the third step. The whole point of the third step prayer is quid pro quo. It's a deal I make with God. I'm saying, hey, God, I want this. And he goes, cool, I want you. I'm offering myself to him. He takes me, because he's going to do a better job with me than I have. You look at the wreckage of my life up to that point, and I'm obviously a crappy manager. But I'm giving me to God so he can change me. He can transform me. He can mold me. And the more I do the steps, the more malleable I become. The more open-minded I become. The more willing I am to change I become. So I share all this in a fifth step, which I was pretty sure lightning was going to strike my ass dead because I had been that guy. And my sponsor laughed at a couple of the ones I thought were really bad. But by the way, that always pisses us off. I'm like, what do you mean that you're laughing? You know? He's like, ah. I was like, I thought that was a pretty big deal, man. You know? He's like, nah, I did it. And then he shared two things on his list that I did not write down on mine. But I meant to. I wanted to, but I was embarrassed to. I was going to take him to the grave. And he shared those two things with me, and it was a powerful experience. And I sat there, and for the first time ever, I dropped my guard with another human being. It was the most intimate of experiences I've ever felt. You know, there's a pamphlet called A Member's Eye View of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in the pamphlet, the writer, he says, you know, I'm personally convinced that the basic search of every human being from the cradle to the grave is to find one person before whom they could stand completely naked, stripped of all pretense and defense, and trust that person not to hurt them. That's what we do here. We come in here all bound up. And by the way, I love it when you get the brand new guy. He's in the corner with his arms crossed, giving you that best jailhouse stare. You know, it's like, don't you even think about coming over here. You know, and you walk up to him going, hey, how you doing? All right. We got that excitement and that joy. Because see, we're free. He ain't. And he's pissed off at us because somehow we're free. And I love that look on his face when we're like, keep coming back. Yeah. He's like, if I could beat your ass, I would. Yeah. All right, man, that's okay. That's all right, you can beat my ass. We'll put it on your ninth step. Come on. Yeah. So I shared this stuff with God, and then I look at six, because six is what is really the cool transition point. This is the stuff I have admitted are objectionable. Not what the Bible or any of the religious book has said is objectionable. Not what society has said is objectionable. Not what my parents, not what my employers. This is the stuff that I'm saying doesn't work. And I'm going to take that to God. And I take that to God in seven. I say, God, take all of me, the good and the bad. I ask now that you remove all from me all those things that are objectionable, that don't work with you. I'm paraphrasing the hell out of that one. You know, I'm a book guy, but God bless, I need to really open it up more and read it instead of remembering what it says in my head, because in my head it'll be changed. And then I get this list of people I'm looking at in 8 and 9. And 8 and 9 for me was another just amazing experience, because there's something that happens when I face somebody and I admit what I've done is wrong. And actually admit what it is. Not just talk about, hey, I'm sorry I stole your money, but actually talk about, hey, in the middle of a run, I betrayed a confidence. I took from you. I stole from you. I didn't stop to think how it affected you. Here's your money, and I'm very sorry for what I've done. What else can I do to make it right? And there's something that happens, man. Now, I've never had somebody not take the money. They always seem to take the money. But most of them have been really cool. One of the most best experiences was with my mom. I thought it was just the money thing, and I slid the money across the table, and she pushed it back. When they don't take the money, they want to take it out of your ass. And nobody can get in your ass like mom, all right? And she did. And she proceeded to tell me how she robbed me of 6 months of her life. Because what she did is she sat up all hours of the day and night, had two notebooks, 30-something pages in each, covered with hospitals, jails, morgues, detoxes, treatment centers, four states. And she had called so many different counties, I can't even think of all of them. And she would call them repeatedly every week to find out if I had been there. I thought all I was doing was stealing a little bit of money. Remember that lie we tell ourselves, I'm not hurting anybody? That one was crushed that day. And I'm happy to say my mom and I have an amazing relationship today. So do all my family. I love them. They've forgiven me for so many transgressions. And I was able to clean up so much wreckage of my past. I actually got a checking account. I remember going to 8111. I was like a year and a half sober. And they're like, has anybody got anything to share? And I was like, hey, look, I did a checking account. I was 29 years old. I hadn't had a checking account since I was 18, man. Because if there's checks in the book, there's money in the bank, right? No, they blackballed my ass. I remember that feeling. 8111, by the way, not a really cool place to do that because most people over there seem to have some money and stuff, but it was a big deal for me. I remember the experience of going for the first time and practicing step 10 with somebody. That was a really cool one. You know, I actually walked up to them because it says in the book, you know, when these crop up, immediately, you know, I asked God to remove it, went and talked with somebody else, made amends, da da da. And as I went to talk to the guy about what was going on, he goes, what are you doing? It's weird, by the way. Sometimes in AA, you'll walk up to somebody and make an amends to them. They wonder what the hell you're doing. You got two steps for that one. But that was my experience. And then it's practicing 11 to 12. 11 was a big deal for me because I got into the habit of praying with other people. And I don't know about you, but there's something about when two of us get together, there's power. By the way, I'm pretty sure the power in this room did not exist this morning when somebody first opened the doors. But as more and more of us show up, the power increases. There's something about us. We're a part of something. There's a collectiveness to us. We can do what I couldn't. And the more we there is, the more power there seems to be. And I have no idea who's going to be transmitting the power on any given day. But we're conduits. We become instrument of God's help. He transmits something to us and through us. Sometimes it's even coming out of our mouths. And it's not even what we say. It's what God hears within us. It's like we got this little voice in the back of our head that says, that was great. And it's like it triggers this thought that initiates a conversation with my sponsor or initiates a conversation with the person who shared it, you know. And something about that consciousness that we bring into this conversation of recovery, because that's what it is. It all started with a busted up proctologist, ass doctor, go figure, and another guy who's a stock speculator, stock broker wannabe. And they were both broken, and they were both trying to get help, and they were both trying to do something, and it started with a handshake and a conversation, which is so funny because it's exactly what we do here today. Hey, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. My name's Christian. Can I get you some coffee? Have you ever been here before? Do you have a big book? And just sit down and have a conversation. That's what it happens. And in 12, and I'll just wrap it up with this because that's been the biggest part of my life for the last 14 years, having had a spiritual experience, awakening. I like awakening much better than experience. Experience is like one-time thing, you know? And awakening is I'm more awake now at 10 minutes to 9 than I was at 9 a.m. this morning. I'm more awakened spiritually at 14 years than I was at a year. All right? It doesn't make me anything more than just more awakened, you know? When trouble comes, I feel it quicker. When self crops up, I just seem to feel it quicker. I have a low tolerance for spiritual pain. Doesn't mean I don't play with it. I wrestle with spiritual pain a lot, but I got a really low tolerance for it. And having had a spiritual awakening was the whole point of this thing, is to have this, to be relieved of the bondage of self, to experience the promise that we have in the second step. You know, coming to believe power greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity. Sane people don't drink poison. Sane people don't throw their lives away. Sane people are connected to what they're doing. They have a purpose today. You know, my primary purpose is to carry this message. I can carry this message at work by practicing principles. I can carry this message at meetings by greeting newcomers and being of service. I can carry this message to sponsees by being available and helping them walk through the 12 steps. I carry this message at home with my wife, and we get to experience that. We practice the principles of AA in step form and in tradition form in our home. Our common worth is much more important than anything outside of the house. You know, we are more important than me. You know, and I learned in that from couples who are celebrating healthy relationships in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm thankful for them. I'm thankful for those who teach us how to be married, who teach us how to get engaged, you know. But I met my wife, Lori, and it's probably the greatest gift I've received in sobriety is my relationship with my wife. And I gush over her, by the way. deal with it. but I met her. She was on staff at a treatment center over in Sumter, South Carolina, and I got the opportunity. I used to do book studies, and I love doing them because it allows me for 17 hours to just be nuts, you know, and carry the message and have fun and be of service. And it's the greatest gift to be of service, because when I'm in service, I'm not up in here. When I'm of service, I open a gateway for God to come in, and I get to meet people who change my life. And she changed my life. And she came up and she had a big book of smile and blonde hair, and that's it for me. I love that. And she asked a question out of the big book, and it was a great question. It was out of the ninth step, you know. It was like, cool. And I answered her based on my experience, not upon my whatever supposed knowledge of the big book. But something told me I'm going to talk to her again, and we ended up courting. Courting. It's different than dating. Courting. Google it. Yeah. It's old school dating, all right? She lived in Sumter. I lived in Atlanta. We courted. I fell in love with her before I had ever touched her. We've been married for over 5 years now. And it's the greatest pure relationship I've ever had with another human being. And I learned how to do that by Men and Alcoholics Anonymous teaching me what intimacy is, teaching me what trust is, teaching me accountability, teaching me compatibility, you know? Because there's so much more going on here than just how good looking you are, or how much money you got, or where your daddy grew up, or how educated you are. It's much more. It's about an emotional, spiritual connection. There's a spiritual compatibility. It's like God says, that's her. Now, my head says, no, there's like 18 or 19 hers in here. No, God's like, no, that's her. And I couldn't explain why I felt like I had to call her and talk to her. And we courted and we got engaged and we got married in her daddy's church over in Lake City, South Carolina. We had an amazing wedding, had an amazing experience for the last 5+ years. And we live in this program. We love what this program offers us. The job I have is a direct result of this program. My sponsor suggested when my back went out, when I was 8 months sober, he says, you're going to have to go check out this other thing. So I went into this place and they tested to see if I could type. Now I'm a high school dropout. I don't have any paperwork that says I'm smart enough to do any of the jobs that I'm currently doing. And I started doing this typing test and I hadn't burned away those brain cells. And I learned how to send an email. And 13+ years ago, I got a job working for a major corporation. I make more money legally now. There's a caption in that, legally now, than I ever have in my life. And they provide security and they provide stability, and I'm still amazed they hired me. I'm still amazed that I somehow seem to be doing well in a job I'm not qualified for. And then one of these days, they're going to figure it out. You know, I'm pretty sure 14 years at that job, they'll finally say, wait a minute, he don't know what the hell he's doing. You know, but you guys taught me how to show up, how to suit up, how to be accountable, how to present your best self. Not the false version of us, the bravado and the ego, but the pure version of us, the integrity. That's a big word for people like us, integrity. Integrity means my word is bond. When I shake your hand and I look you in the eye and I say I'm going to do it, I do it. I mean what I say and I say what I mean. But see, when I started drinking, I didn't know what that word meant. I didn't know how that feeling was. I didn't know what it was to be connected to a human group of people. I mean, amazing group of people who have the power to help others change. We ourselves are not. We're like batteries. It's like we get a 24-hour charge every day, and we get this amazing power to attract people to us, to help them find their own truth, and to help them seek a deeper truth. And I like what the big book says here about the purpose of each. You know, there's a couple different places, and I'll sum it up with this. You know, we hear people get to the podium and saying, you know, I'm going to share with you what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like now. That's one thing we're supposed to do. I like how the big book suggests in our personal stories. You're going to hear people describe in their own language and from their own point of view the way they established their relationship with God. Go on to page 50. It tells me, you know, a couple different ways of looking at how we do this. How I approach and conceive of a power which is greater than myself. Whether you agree with my particular approach or conception seems to make little difference. We all have questions. We all have experiences. We all want to have a little something that's a little different. I found it as a result of working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous in the Big Book. I found it by being a part of a group like Half Place. 33 years of doing something that is changing people's lives. People dying with alcoholism, not from it. I've had people come up to me saying, you know what, you have too much energy, you're too little, too animated. And I'm like, all right, you can do an inventory on it if you don't like it. And then somebody actually accused me once. I was giving out the chips. saw a guy giving out the chips, and he held up a chip, and he held up a white chip. And he was like,
if you want what we have.
And I'm like, no, sit down. Sit down, man. I went up there, and I took the chip out of his hand, and I said, you know what? If you're dying, if you're in pain, if you're lost, if you're confused, if you were so frustrated over how life is treating you, we have a white chip. It's not my job to see that you have alcoholism. It's my job to help you discover for yourself if you have alcoholism. My job is to help people identify with the restlessness, irritability, discontentment, with the racing thoughts and the crazy feelings, the anxiety that just won't go away. And guess what? Everybody in this room experiences some of that every day. We have a program that works in rough going. We have a program that, if a practice is a way of life, expels the obsession to drink and enables us to be happily and usefully whole. That's what we have. What we have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. And I learn how to do that every day in here. I learn how to do that every day by listening to you, watching you, experiencing you. See, you're changing, and we see it before you do. It freaks us out sometimes. We're like, whoa! See how much he's changing? You see how much they're changing? We see it happen. And then what's really cool is we don't just keep it for ourselves. We bring it back and we're like, brother, I'm proud of you, man. Hey, sister, you're doing the good job. Hey, what you shared in that meeting last night was on point. You know, I'm so proud of what you're doing. I'm so proud of how much you're accomplishing. Thank you. You're doing good. And I love that because what we need is that encouragement. So 33 years, I'm looking for another 33 years. You know, I was 10 years old when Help Place opened. I'm 43 years old now. And the best years of my life have been the last 14. And for that, I thank Alcoholics Anonymous at places like Help Place. Happy anniversary.